awakening. Because that's what it's all about, right, isn't it? Waking up. I mean, that's what we're here for. That's what life's about. And we all think, I mean, all of us here, we're awake. Yep. I mean, if it was after lunch, I might think some of you were possibly asleep, but here we are, first lecture in the conference, so early morning, so all awake. But what all the great mystics have said time and time again is, really, we're asleep most of the time. We're not really awake. We're functioning on automatic. We're living a sort of dream life world. We do things without really thinking about them. We're not living in the present moment. We don't know who we are. We have this idea of who we are, how people see me, what I do, my personality, but that's not really who we are. We're asleep to our deeper, our real identity, who we really are. And so the call has been again and again to wake up in life, to really become who we truly are. And that's what I want to look at today, is what that means, how we can do that, or just some inklings. I mean, there's thousands of years of spiritual traditions on how to do that. I'm not going to pack all that into 1 hour, but just a general sense of what that involves. But also, I want to look at why this is so important right now at this time of history, this time in the history of the planet. Because I think this right now is the most exciting time to have ever lived. It's the most exciting time, I think, for the planet, for us. Also the most challenging time. We can all see that. And to actually put this awakening process in that context. Because human beings, we've just been here for, what, a million or so years? Maybe a few million years, depends when you decide human beings began. We're just a tiny, tiny fraction of time in Earth's history. If the planet's 5 billion years old, 4.5 billion years old, then Homo sapiens is somewhere around a tenth of a percent of human history, a bit more maybe. And then, you know, in a fraction of that time, we developed language, we started speaking to each other. 5,000 years ago or so, we started writing, recording things, beginning to share ideas, pass ideas on to people, other cultures, other times. 500 years ago, we invented printing, being able to mass produce things. 100 years ago, radio. 104 years ago, Marconi invented radio. And he had this vision. I think it was 1902. He had this vision of everybody being able to talk to each other by radio. And everybody thought he was crazy. All he could do at that time was, you know, get a message to go across the street. He could tap something and somewhere across the street could pick up the spark. And here we are today, we make 40 billion phone calls a day. And we send 10 billion email messages a day. The global brain is connecting up. And in ways we can't even imagine. I mean, I wrote the book, The Global Brain, came out in 82. I was writing it in the 70s. All of us back then were totally wrong. We had a sense of where things were going. I could see the networking of computers was going to start linking things up. But we were all thinking about data being exchanged. We didn't think how it was going to be exchanged. We didn't imagine, for example, streaming on the internet. You could watch video, you could watch television on the internet. We thought it was all going to be data. We didn't see any of that. In fact, even the people who developed the World Wide Web in 1990 didn't see that. They didn't even see images. They didn't see shopping. All of that's happened in just the last 10 years. And we've no idea where things are going. The future always, if you could see into the future, it would always look magic. Because we cannot see innovation. We cannot see the new things that are going to happen. I mean, I've got a little piece of magic here. You know, you all recognize it. This is why I do my Steve Jobs bit. You know, I don't believe this. For those who can't see it, it's an iPod. You know, in there, there's a little tiny bit of something which has 24 hours of music on it. Now, I have a degree in computer science. I know how much data there is in 1 second of music. It's impossible to get that in there. They are doing magic, but don't want to tell us because we wouldn't believe it. But seriously, imagine if you showed Mozart one of these. You know, your whole life's work in perfect fidelity, all those violinists, everything, all in there. He just said, you know, come on. Ridiculous. And here we are. So wherever we're going, and remember, wherever we're going there faster and faster and faster because things are speeding up, as we all know. The future, 5, 10, 20 years down the road, is going to seem like magic to us. If we could be shown now what we'd be doing in 10 years' time, we'd shake our heads and say, come on. I mean, they reckon by 2020, we're going to have your average personal computer will have the same capacity as your brain. Which means we'll have computers as smart as us. And then they start designing computers that are even smarter. Look at where biotechnology is going in terms of probably we'll have the way it's going, we'll probably be able to heal cancer, many cancers medically, deal with many genetic diseases, many viruses. Probably the most interesting thing is we're now understanding the aging process in cells. It's probably only another 5 years before we actually will understand how to switch that off. 10 years' time, that might actually be coming available. Which means if you keep yourself healthy now, in 10 years' time, your life expectancy may be 150. So I'm serious. So much is opening up. And so much seems to push towards the year 2020. So much of the technology breakthroughs are going towards 2020. I know a lot of us look at 2012 for various reasons, which is pretty close. It was only 6 years ago we had the millennium, and that just seems like yesterday. 2012 is only 6 years further ahead. 2020 is only 14 years ahead. Wherever we're going, this world is coming very quickly. But also 2020 is significant because that seems to be the date. I'm not talking about the actual year. Let me make this clear because I made this mistake before. I mean around then. I see myself, Peter Russell says in 2020 this is going to happen. I mean around that time, 2018, 2022, whatever. But around that period is when the environmental crisis really will have hit us. I mean, we're seeing it beginning to hit now, but by 2020, we're going to be in deep doo-doo. It's going to be clear what's happened, what we've done. And I think it's going to be heart-wrenching to see what we've actually done to the planet, the havoc we've wrought to the planet. And we already see the beginning signs of this in pollution, increasing pollution everywhere, the air, the soil, the oceans, the decimation of the rainforest, which is not stopping. One of the biggest decimators at the moment is China in its economic growth, needing wood, and it's realized the dangers of chopping down its own forests, so a lot of other forests in Asia just fueling wood into China and other countries. I don't want to single China out, but it's one of the fastest growing economies. The loss of soil, arable soil, at the same time as the population is still growing, it's slowing down but still growing. Oil, we all know that. Just the price rises we're seeing now. And people talk about peak oil. You've probably heard about peak oil. It used to be thought the oil crisis would hit when the oil ran out. And everybody said, oh, we've got enough oil for another 50 years, another 100 years, don't have to worry. The oil crisis hits when the demand exceeds the production. And we've reached the maximum rate of production more or less now. After this, it becomes more expensive to get even more oil out of the ground. And the demand is going up. And that's why we're seeing the price going up. And that's going to run through and affect everything in that society. And of course, there's climate change, which we're all well aware of. And we've just had less than 1 degree, a fraction of 1 degree average rise so far, and we're seeing shifts in weather patterns, which probably a reflection of that. It now looks like even if we stopped now, brought all our CO2 emissions down to the same level now, we'd see a 3 degree rise. And that's going to cause major changes in weather patterns with all the resultant consequences. So we're living not only in the most exciting times technologically, so much potential, but also I think the most dangerous, challenging times ever, certainly in human history. I mean, there may have been a few times like when asteroids hit the Earth, been probably 5, 6, 7 of those in the past, which were equally calamitous. But we are now living through a similar time that's human generated. This isn't an asteroid hitting the Earth. This is human generated. Every one of these crises, when you track them back, what is their origin? Their origins come from human behavior, which comes from human decision making, human thinking, human values, what we think is important. And so often, what we think is important is not what's important for the bigger picture, it's what's important for my bank account, for my self-image. I mean, how many of the problems does greed play a role? Or short-term thinking? Or just not willing to admit we're wrong, even. Or just human ego. I remember Plato said something, good old Plato. He said, anybody who wants to be a leader, the very fact of them wanting to be a leader should immediately ban them. Let alone spending $200 million to do it, or whatever it is in this country. So the crisis we're facing is basically a crisis of consciousness. It's a crisis of values. It's a crisis in human thinking. And a crisis, any crisis, is a sign that the old way isn't working. Something new is needed. The old way isn't working any longer. And perhaps the old way of thinking, that limited, self-centered, me, my community, what I have, my possessions, that may have worked in the past reasonably well. It did cause a lot of conflict and wars in the past, but we got by on it. We've now reached a point in our collective history where that is not working. It's destroying our environment and ultimately destroying us. And as many of you know, the old Chinese symbol for crisis, Wei Yi Qi, the Chinese word, means two things, danger and opportunity. And here we are with incredible danger, but also incredible opportunity. And I think the real opportunity today is not in the technology. I mean, there's incredible opportunities in the technology, but the real opportunity is in us. The planet's asking us, demanding of us, that we wake up. This is the time to actually do it. I mean, the great mystics, philosophers, the saints, the sages, the yogis, they've been telling us to do it for thousands of years. These are people who have delved within themselves, looked at their own consciousness, looked at how the mind gets caught, how it gets trapped in its thinking, its judgments, its grievances, its aversions, see the effect that has on our own consciousness and the effect it has on others. And they've seen ways to step out of that, to let it go. And they've urged us to do the same thing, to wake up. What tends to have happened is people have listened to them. They said, wow, that person looks really happy. They seem to be wise. I want to be there. And they've listened and taken the teachings, and they've absorbed it into their own framework, into the culture of the time, understood bits of it, misunderstood other bits of it, didn't quite do the practices right, whatever, told other people who misunderstood a bit more, lost a bit more. You know, it's a bit like taking a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy. Gradually becomes unreadable. I think this is what's happened to spiritual wisdom. It's popped up, who knows, thousands, thousands, thousands of times it's popped up. As soon as you stop, you start becoming quiet, opening up. We all have an incredible inner wisdom in us all. We just don't see it because we're so caught up with our worries, our wondering about what might happen. Did we say the right thing yesterday? What somebody's thinking of me? I must remember to do this, blah, 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 blah. You know, the conversation that goes on, the commentary that goes on inside our head, we don't notice this inner wisdom that's there. We all have it. And there have been people who've woken up to it. And then it just, as I say, gets absorbed by the culture and ends up as religion. A set of doctrines, dogmas that are very worthy, very well-intentioned, but the fire has gone out. Waking up, for me, is each of us rediscovering that wisdom for ourselves, each and every one of us. And that's what it's about, is each of us doing that work, rediscovering it. It's easy to say, you know, the world is in a mess, people are whatever it is, greedy, self-centered. They have to change. Particularly when we look at our leaders, we can see all those faults in our leaders very easily. They are the ones who've got to change. And I know people think, how can I change the thinking of somebody? I'm sure you can all think of a few. I have all those problems. They just have them in aces. I have some of them in aces, actually. We all, I mean, you know, if we're honest, we all have aspects of ourselves which get a bit attached to things, money things, greed, thinking we're right about certain things, knowing we're right about certain things, and other people are therefore wrong, stupid, closed-minded, whatever it is. And they, of course, know they're right, and we're the ones who are stupid, closed-minded. It's each of us doing that. I sometimes think what we're doing is we're transforming the world one person at a time. The one person we have responsibility for. The good thing is there's millions and millions and millions of people, probably 100 million people, doing that one person at a time transformation. So let me look a bit at waking up. What I mean by waking up. Because we think we're awake, but as I said earlier, what we get caught up in the thinking the stories we tell ourselves. And if I watch myself, most of the time I'm caught up in something or other, some thought stream. And it's usually about something that's from the past, something that's happened, some memory, or very often, probably more often, something that might happen, might not happen. What am I going to do? Planning something that never actually needs to be planned when it came to it. I think it was Mark Twain said, "My life has been full of disasters, most of which never happened." When I look at myself, most of the stuff I'm caught up in, I'd be much better off without 90% of it. I mean, a good exercise for me is driving. When I'm driving, I don't need to be thinking much. And yet I notice my mind going on about things. I see something that triggers me. I'm thinking about this, whatever. I'm much better off if I can just be aware of myself, the car, the road, what's happening. If I'm distracted in my thoughts, I'm not present to what is. And this is something Eckhart Tolle made very clear. Is there a dead spot around here, or is it just me? It's my mic. I move. Okay. He points out that he says all our thinking is about the past or the future. So when we're thinking, we can't be in the present moment. And that's what all the great teachers have said. You know, it's about coming back to being present. And how do we do that more and more times each day? And then we get caught up in our patterns of thinking. We have lots of beliefs that have been instilled in us, more or less from the moment we're born, about how to behave, what to do. And we do them automatically. It's like we're on autopilot a lot of the time. And one very common one is related to our whole approach to the world around us. I mean, the basic thing that we all want, every human being, every one of us, and I would say not just human beings, probably every creature, the fundamental motivation, what we all want, is we want to feel okay. Whether you call it being happy, being at peace, fulfilled, satisfied. The bottom line, our real bottom line, is an inner psychological bottom line. Our real bottom line is, how do we feel? None of us want to be in pain. None of us want to suffer. We want to feel content, comfortable, at ease, happy, whatever it is. The words don't matter. The principle is we want to feel okay. It's how we feel inside, our state of being, our state of consciousness. That's the bottom line. And we are fed with this belief from the moment we're born, through our parents, because they know no better, most of them. Some of us were fortunate and have wise parents, but most of us didn't. They were caught up in the system as much as anybody. Through the media, through education, we're fed with this belief that says, if you're not feeling okay, if you're not feeling comfortable, if you're feeling unhappy, if you're feeling miserable, do something about it. And so we start looking for, we try to get things. Oh, if I had that, I'd feel better. If I did this, I'd feel better. And the joke, sad joke, as someone once pointed out, is we're no longer human beings, we're human havings and doings. That's what drives us. We no longer take time to be, we're so busy doing. And it's not just doing out there. We get into a doing mode of consciousness. I mean, I notice that a lot of my time I'm just doing inside my head. The other day I noticed I was so busy doing, I hadn't noticed the rain had stopped. It was a beautiful day out there. I looked out the windows, my God. I hadn't noticed. I was so caught up in this doing mode of consciousness. But it's this that keeps us consuming things we don't really need. This is why we love money so much. I mean, money in itself, you can't love. But what we love is the fact that it can buy us the things, the opportunities, the friends, whatever it is we think will make us happy. So the result is we become a victim of the world. If circumstances change, we start making ourselves unhappy, and then we start trying to do things to make ourselves happy again. And I say make ourselves unhappy. What the Buddha pointed out, I think one of the Buddha's key insights, I mean, he was one of these great people who got the truth, and probably Buddhism is the one religion where it hasn't got too obscured over time. What he realized was the natural state of mind is one of being at ease. And what we do is we make ourselves uncomfortable because we think we're missing something and we start wanting things to be different. And so what happens in our world, we think we're missing something, we need something, so we go out and buy it. You know, we go and buy ourselves a new jacket or something, and we feel better. And we make the mistake of thinking it was going and getting that thing that shopping made us feel better. Retail therapy. What it does is we temporarily stopped making ourselves feel bad. There was no longer something we were telling ourselves we were missing, and so we stopped making ourselves feel bad, and then a day later or 10 minutes later, we notice there's something else we're missing, something else we think, if only I had that, I'd feel better. That's the trap we get caught in. That's one area where we're really asleep in our culture. We just do things without actually thinking whether we need them or not, whether it's appropriate. What are the consequences? It's like we're hypnotized the whole time, or most of the time. Waking up is when you wake up from the hypnosis. And I think the wisdom, as I said, is there inside us. There's a very interesting experiment people have done in hypnosis. It's called the Hidden Observer experiment. And a typical experiment, one of the early ones they did, they hypnotized a person, and they brought in a bucket of ice cold water. Now, any of you know, if you've ever been in ice cold water, unfortunately, it's not just cold, it's painful. And they told the person to stick their arm in this bucket of ice cold water, but telling them it was ordinary room temperature water. So it wasn't going to be. So the person sticks the arm in, thinking, what, under hypnosis, being told, it's ordinary water. It's actually painful, freezing cold water. And they say, how is it? The person says, fine. Any discomfort? No problems. And then they said, okay, over here is a pencil and paper. Without looking, allow the other hand to start writing things, sort of automatic writing. We call it channeling these days. Let the other hand start writing. And it started writing, ouch, it hurts, it's cold, stop the experiment. There's that level of knowing, which I call our wisdom self, which knows the truth, below the hypnosis. We respond outwardly the way we're expected to. Deep down, we know the truth. And I think that's true with us. We know the truth. We know that having even more things doesn't make us any happier, and yet we find ourselves being pulled to go and do those things. So waking up is, one way you can think of it is waking up from our hypnosis. But another analogy, which I think is even more powerful, is what happens in dreaming when we're asleep at night. And how when you're asleep, you're completely caught up in your dreams, they become the reality, you forget there's a waking world most of the time, you're there in the dream reality with all the emotions that are happening, and you know, you wake up with your heart pumping, whatever it is, you're totally in that reality. You're dreaming, you're still conscious, but you're not awake to the dream. And then there's those moments which we call lucid dreaming, which I'm sure most of you experience from time to time, and which you can develop, where you wake up in the dream and you realize you're dreaming. And you realize it's all a story that you're telling yourself. And the story goes on. And then you find you can start having a choice. You can start directing the story. You can start directing the dream. And you might decide, this dream's getting a bit frightening here. It's only a dream. I don't want to experience a frightening bit in my dream. I can steer it away. And you start changing the dream. That's called lucid dreaming, where you wake up in the dream. And I think what the great mystics and saints are talking about, waking up, for us, I would call it lucid waking. Lucid daily life is waking up in our normal daily activity to what's going on. Waking up to the thoughts that are going around ahead, the stories we are telling ourselves. Here's that judgment thought coming up again. This person is whatever it is, silly, stupid, greedy, whatever. Most of our judgments tend to be like, we're better than them. Sometimes it's not, but then to catch them, isn't that interesting? Here it comes again. Do I want to follow that thought or not? We have a choice. I remember recently I was with a couple of friends, and one was saying, I really can't forgive this person for what they said. And it turned out this was something from 6 months ago, and they were still saying, I can't forgive this person. I forget what it was, but they'd said or done something awful, and this person saying, I really can't forgive them. And my other friend, she said, I'm so sorry for you. You know, we think when we hold a grievance, the person we're hurting is them. I'm thinking bad thoughts about you, therefore you are suffering. They didn't even know what's going on. The person who's suffering is us, because we're not at ease, we're not at peace, we're telling ourselves all this stuff. It's letting go of it. Waking up comes from just letting go of this stuff. We have a choice. And I think this is one of the key things, is recognizing we always have a choice. Most of the time when we're caught in our like half awake state, we don't recognize we have a choice. We're on automatic. But in principle, every moment of our day, we have a choice about whether to follow a thought or not, how to see the situation. That's probably the most profound choice of all, is how do we actually see a situation? There's the situation out there, and then we make a choice about how we see it, how we interpret it. And an example I often use is being stuck in a traffic jam. You know, you have a choice. We don't recognize it. Usually we're on automatic, and the automatic voice in our head says, I'm going to be late. If I'm late, bad things are going to happen. I'm going to be late for the appointment, for the interview, getting home, whatever it is. Things are not going to work out as I wanted them to work out. Therefore, I'm not going to be happy. And if we really get into it, we start triggering anxiety and blood pressure goes up. And yet when you think about it, being in a traffic jam is much less stressful than driving a car. You haven't got to do anything. You haven't got to worry about that driver coming the other way, about that pedestrian stepping out in front of you and what's going to happen here and this idiot behind you. Nothing's happening anymore. It's the most relaxed part of driving. And you could be sitting back saying, this is what I've been waiting for all day. You've got no computers bugging you in the car, nobody coming in with problems for you to solve. You're on your own. It's the perfect situation, and there you are getting upset. We have a choice. You could even look around and sort of look at all the other people and say, isn't this interesting? The human condition, all these people getting upset. People sticking their hands on the horn with this magical idea that if you make a lot of noise, then whatever it is that's causing the traffic jam vaporizes. I don't know where that belief system came from, but it's... So... when we do this, when we do break out of this hypnotic state we're in, what all the great teachers then point out is what we start touching into is just who we really are. We start seeing our true nature. And they give it various names. Some talk about its natural mind, our inner essence, the unconditioned mind, pure consciousness. There's many different names given to it. And ordinarily, we don't see it. We don't even know it's there. I think it's a bit like if you were a culture, if you lived in a world, a place in the world or on a planet where it was cloudy the whole time, like Venus. But it could be, there was always cloudy. You wouldn't know there was a sun. You'd know there was light, and you'd know it got light for half the time, and then it got dark. And you might have all these mythologies about why it got light. There was a light god which turned the lights on or something. And you know, there would be light, and there would be dark. But you wouldn't know there was something else. There was a source of that light until the clouds cleared. And I think the way we live most of the time, the cloud is the cloud of our thinking mind, the feeling stuff we're going through, all this stuff we get lost in. I'd say the stories that are going on. And we don't notice there's something underneath that's there the whole time. Just this natural level of being, natural level of consciousness, which the mystics describe as having various qualities. It has, when you connect with it, there's a state of ease. There's usually a feeling of relief and release. And you realize, all the time I've been looking for something out there that's going to give me this, and it's there inside us all along. But it was clouded over. We just have to remove those veils, and it begins to become apparent. And it's not that it's not a thing that becomes apparent, it's more just a feeling of being, a mode of being. It's this sense that it's, you know, it's always been there. It's not like you've discovered something new. You just, why didn't I recognize this before? I realize it's always been there, but I didn't notice it. This state of ease, relief, peace. It's the peace that passeth all understanding. Not in the sense that it cannot be understood, which may be true, but it's that which passeth, it lies beyond our understanding minds. It's there. It's that state of being. And when you're in touch with that, there's no need to start judging people for who they are. If someone's a certain way, that's the way they are. You don't need to get into all these stories about how they are. There's no longer a clinging to things or wanting things to be a certain way, because in that moment, how things are is how things are. You may want to change things in the future, but there's no point in resisting the present, which is what a lot of us do. We resist how things are, accept how things are. There's this ease that comes. And the other thing that many of the great teachers point out through their own discovery, is that this also has the quality of love to it. It's like when we touch into who we are, we find that deep down, there's just this quality of love. It's not the love we know on the surface, which is usually focused on something, very often, usually somebody, because they're a certain way that's going to make us feel good, which is a lot, that's the most superficial. I love you because you act and think and do and dress and all these things the way that I think the perfect person should, therefore I love you. And don't ever change or I won't love you anymore. I'm being crass, but you get the picture. This isn't love that's focused on anything or anybody. That's why it's called unconditional love. It doesn't depend upon any conditions in the world. It comes from the unconditioned mind, the mind that is not conditioned, that pure level of mind. And it's just a quality in the heart. You just realize it's that quality that's there all along. So I go out chasing it. when it's there, deep inside. But that's what we do. We get caught in this belief that it must be out there. Or not it's out there, but if I just get the right things, possessions, circumstances, people, get them to behave the right way. I mean, how much time do we spend trying to manipulate other people to behave the way we think they should behave in order that we feel okay? That's part of the trap. And what they all say, time and again, is the way to this is letting go. And they use different words: surrender, release, forgiveness. It's interesting, the word forgiveness in Greek, in the Gospels, the word that's in the Greek version, is translated into English, is aphesis. A-P-H-E-S-I-S, for those who need to know. Aphesis, if you look it up in the dictionary, means to physically let go, release. To let go of something, it means to release. How do you let go? And I hear, you know, people say, oh, if only I could let go. And people say, oh, just let go of that. And we start thinking letting go is something you do. You can't do letting go. What you can do is stop holding on. But that's a release process. But because we're in this doing mode, we bring this attitude of doing to the very task of letting go, and we get ourselves stuck. And I think a lot of spiritual practices are, they're almost like tricks to get you to actually do the letting go, to develop that skill of how to release yourself, how to let go. And another thing that they point out time and time again is that the best teacher of all is not some guru out there who's already got it, who can tell you all these things and paint these wonderful pictures of what it's like when you've got it and how they got it and what you need to do. The best guru of all is inside. We each have an incredible teacher, what I call the wisdom self, which knows everything. Everything these wonderful, enlightened people know, I believe we have the essence of that knowing in ourselves. All they've done is opened up to something that's absolutely universal. So we have that teacher. So the question is, how do we access our own inner guru, our own inner guidance? And this is something I've become fascinated in the last few years, because by doing this, I believe we can really deepen and accelerate our own inner awakening. We don't have to, you know, go off once a year for a week to find some teacher. When we start developing this, we can do it each and every moment of the day that we choose to, wherever we are. And I'm sure we all use guidance a lot. You know, most of you here probably, we use guidance very much on what to do. You know, you look at the program here and you think, which workshop should I do? I've got a choice of four. Let me tune into my inner guidance here. And we use it in many, many other ways. But we don't use it much to invite the wisdom self to guide us in our own journey of awakening. And what I've been intrigued by, and I'll be looking at this more in the workshop tomorrow, going through some practical stuff with it, is how do we open up to this? And what struck me as being really valuable is what I call curiosity, the principle of curiosity. Because true curiosity has couple of aspects. One, it says, I don't know. And there's an openness. I don't know, but I'm open to finding out, to knowing. Where's my eye? Here. I hope I can guarantee that none of you know what's in here. You You could be curious as to what's on here. And you could, you know, you could say, well, what I know of Peter Russell is this may be his certain tastes in music, or there may be other things. You can make a guess. The only way you know what's in here is by actually getting in there, listening to it, completely open-minded, and the answer presents itself to you. And that's what's nice about curiosity. The answer presents itself. It takes you out of the mind, takes you out of the thinking mind. So in these processes, it's about stepping beyond the mind to allow the wisdom self, which is beyond the thinking mind, beyond understanding, to present you with something else. I mean, a simple, this is just almost like a training example. And this is not about guidance, but right now, I could ask you the question, what stops you falling onto the ground? Now, your mind can come in and say, oh, because there's a chair, I'm sitting on the chair, and the pressure of the chair and gravity, and you can have all that understanding about chairs and stuff. Or you could go for the experiential answer and feel it. There's the pressure, I can feel the pressure of the chair. I can feel the back of the chair holding me, my feet on the ground. I can feel that. That's the answer that reveals itself when you open to the experience. So here's a very simple question, but I find totally profound. Carry this one question around with you and it will serve you well. What is stopping you being more fully present right now? Now you can get into the mind, or you can just open and just hold that question and see what presents itself to you. Just an opening, just holding that question. Is there something that's stopping me being fully present right now? And just noticing what happens. So just you know, play with that as you go through life this week. And those who are coming to the workshop, that's your pre-homework. So, coming back to where I started, these times, as I said, incredible excitement, potential, scientifically, technologically. Someone once said, I think it's probably true, that the whole of the 20th century's knowledge, 50% of that was gained in the last 20 years. And now we're gaining as much knowledge in 14 years, and soon it will be in 7 years. That's accelerating. Science, I touched upon a couple of things in technology. These are exciting times from that point of view. The most dangerous times in terms of the environment, really, really seriously dangerous. And that's becoming clear to almost everybody. And times of incredible potential for waking up to who and what we truly are. And I said, that's what's being demanded of us at this time. I think or hope that in the future we'll look back at this period, the beginning of the 21st century, and not only see it as those two things, but also as the Great Awakening, whatever we want to call it. And it is happening. And we've never had the opportunity for this before on the planet. I mean, in the past, 100, 200 years ago, if you were interested at all in spiritual issues, and most of us were so busy just feeding ourselves, dealing with life, we didn't have much time for it. But even if you were interested, all you probably had access to was whatever shaman, wise person there was in your culture, if there was one, or the particular texts that you've been handed down to read. Today, each of us has access to basically all the world's spiritual traditions, except those that are kept really tightly esoteric, but basically all the world's spiritual traditions going back over the entire history of humanity, or almost all of it. You know, we can go back and look at what the Upanishads in ancient India were saying, or the Vedas. We can go back and study what Buddha was saying 2,500 years ago. We've got all of this available to us. All the world's spiritual traditions. Never had that before. All that wisdom. And what we often forget is there's another, and I would call it a spiritual tradition, which is emerging in the West, which we might call psychotherapy. We don't normally see it as that because it doesn't talk about deities and it doesn't have a myth associated with it. It's not like a religion, but it is, for me, it is spiritual. It is helping people open up, relieve themselves of things which are not appropriate, get in touch with their true self. For me, it fits right in with a spiritual tradition. It just doesn't have all the trappings that we think of as spirituality. And I'm sure most of us here have been through some form of guidance, counseling, help at some stage. None of that was available to our grandparents. Each of us here probably knows more about ourselves and the workings of our minds and the stuff we get into than anybody did 50, 100 years ago. That's also happening. You put all those together, and I believe we are collectively homing in on that core essential spiritual message that so many of the great prophets have discovered thousands and thousands of times individually. We're homing in on that, getting down to the core basic truth. It was somebody once said, it was after one of the very early conferences here where I spoke, somebody came up to me afterwards and said, "What is it you're saying that's different from what everybody else is saying?" And my response was, "Nothing, I hope." You know, we always want something new. There's nothing new about this. It's timeless. And as I said, if I'm saying something different, that's where I'm wrong. I come to events like this because I learn from many of the other speakers here. It helps me. Somebody will say something, you know, Larry will say something, and I go, "Oh yes, that's another bit of my jigsaw, and that fits in, and maybe that gets transformed, and I'll say it, and it fits into you." We're all learning from each other. And when you start learning from each other, when the current state is influenced, when the future state is influenced by the current state, you get what in cybernetics is called positive feedback. Things start growing faster and faster and faster. The more that we all know, the more that we're all waking up in our inner journey, the more we have to share with each other, the more we learn, the faster we grow. So as well as science and technology accelerating and the whole environmental stuff also accelerating, I believe this inner awakening, which we are going through, millions and millions of us, is accelerating. I mean, just think back for yourselves. How many people feel now they've probably done more inner awakening in the last 2, 3, 4 years than they did in the previous 10? Yeah. And I would suggest a lot of that is because the quality of what we're learning, the collective effect, is helping us grow. Look at the number of bookstores. And when I started this, getting interested in this back in my student days in Cambridge, in the largest bookstore in Cambridge in England, there was a shelf that long up in a top corner. I remember exactly where it was. And it had books by Paul Brunton and various other people and Christopher Isherwood. It had everything that was available. And it was probably about 30 books. You know, today, anywhere, there's a couple of bookstores in Santa Fe, full of it. And all of that is the result of people on their own journey, exploring stuff, writing it down, sharing it with others. So we're in this collective phenomena. And that, to me, is what really makes these times just so exciting. I don't know what's going to happen. People always ask me, what's going to happen? I have no idea what the future's going to be like. But I see these three trends coming together, and we're moving into a world where we're going to have technological abilities of one form or another. They're going to seem like magic, which we may misuse and abuse, given the current human nature, that's likely, but also may have the seeds of helping to save us as well. And if we're really going to deal with climate change, we've got to find ways not just of reducing our dependency on fossil fuels, but actually getting some of that CO2 back out the atmosphere. So we're going to need technology. Serious crisis, and probably the most open, wise, caring people collectively we've ever been. How that plays out, I don't know. All I do know is the team I want to play for. So thank you.